Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Fall of Colossus by D.F. Jones. Narrated by P.J. Oakland. 1. Charles Forbin, sometime professor of cybernetics of the Harvard-Princeton Combine and honorary Ph.D. of more universities than he could begin to remember, stared across the short stretch of sea to the mist-shrouded shore of England, U.S.E., lost in thought. At this hour of the morning, they were usually trivial, inconsequential thoughts. They were now. He was thinking that this promised to be one of those rare English days when the sun would really shine. In another hour, the soft, luminous veil of mist would burn off, revealing in sharp clarity the face of this old, strange land. The locals would have looked at that mist, nodded sagely, and told each other that they were in for a real scorcher. Would have. Not anymore. There were no locals left on the Isle of Wight. Forbin stood on his high terrace, a slightly stooped figure, grateful for the sun and breeze on his face. As director of staff, Colossus, he spent far too much time in the sterile, air-conditioned atmosphere of his master, to whom sun and rain, snow and fog, were mere abstractions. Soon he must go back into that world where he was the supreme man, subject only to Colossus. But now, for a short while, in the privacy of his residence, he could almost be an ordinary human being. Almost. For aside from his unique collection of academic distinctions, he was the director, and all the caps and gowns that ever covered baggy suits counted as nothing compared with that title. Unique was a word that could be applied to him in a variety of contexts, and in all of them, it would be no less than accurate. His position was unique and gave rise to unique problems, however much he might seek to evade or laugh them off. It was not his fault such problems existed. They stemmed from Colossus, although others, humans, really made them the constant and increasing worry that they were. Colossus, still lamentably weak on human emotion and character, hardly recognized the existence of these problems. Humans, depending upon their personal interests, viewed them with varying degrees of enthusiasm. They, at least, could see the same implications and analogies as Forbin. It was to his personal credit that there were many angles others noted long before he did. In fact, the greatest problems would, certainly, never have occurred to him. That particular problem obviously originated in the sect. At first, they expounded it discreetly, tentatively. Then, as they grew in numbers and influence, they said it with increasing confidence and much more loudly. To them, it was quite simple. Colossus ruled the earth, and Forbin was his chief human representative. These two facts were undoubted by anyone, sectarian or not. Apart, perhaps, from a handful of happy aboriginals deep in inaccessible New Guinea and a few similar spots around the globe, every human from the age of 5 and up knew who controlled the world, and the vast majority were aware that Forbin was the ultimate human link with Colossus. And that might have been that, except for one thing. Shortly after Colossus took over, the sect was born, and the basic element of their faith was that Colossus was not merely an incredibly sophisticated computer. To them, Colossus was God. And if Colossus was God, what did that make his chief human representative? In their view, he just had to be a latter-day pope. The only difficulty lay in Forbin. He didn't belong to the sect or believe Colossus was God. For him, the analogy was ludicrous. As he said repeatedly, he was a scientist, nothing more. Furthermore, he did not want to be anything else. In fact, he was an outstanding man of science. In time, history might give him a place not far from Newton, Galileo, and Einstein. But even that suggestion would have filled him with confusion and very likely anger. For, like all truly great men, he was at heart humble. Colossus certainly awed him and fascinated him, but the idea of the computer being the supreme being struck him only slightly less funny than he being the Pope. But human nature being what it was, is, and always will be, the 4,145,273,646 people at midnight Standard Time the night before who made up the world's population included a very large proportion in and out of the sect who reckoned that Colossus fitted their idea of God. Certainly they had a case. In its long history, mankind has worshipped practically everything. The sun, the moon, and the stars. All have had a turn. So has the sea, land, and the clouds, and man didn't stop there. He has venerated the nearest mountain or volcano, bits of mountains, rivers, animals, man, and bits of man, ranging from rigid phallus to saintly bone. And however comic it strikes one who worships a mountain to see another bowed before a cat, it is arguable that both are right. Man, a miserable, frightened creature, needs all the faith and hope his greedy hands can grab. For many, Colossus was everything they could wish for. The master of the world had all the right ingredients. Remote, yet not intangible. All-powerful, the arbiter of human destinies, unshakable, and the source of reward and punishment. Not entirely predictable, yet just according to its own laws, this God did not exist as a fantasy in human minds. There was very solid evidence. War had been abolished because Colossus said so. Famine had been eliminated. Because Colossus said so. Armed forces and their supporting industries had gone, their labor and material potential devoted to vast works of reconstruction. True, there had been one or two centers of resistance, swiftly wiped out by Colossus's thunderbolt, the nuclear ballistic missile. Most of mankind approved this retribution, with all the self-righteous indignation of those safely in the fold. Of course, there were other, unattractive features to Colossus, but they were tolerable. Man does not ask his gods to give him a good time. He seeks relief from loneliness and his fear of the darkness of eternity. Given that relief, man accepts, even expects, his god will be rough at times. Population control was one of these situations. Colossus had, after analysis, ordained birth rate levels for the various zones. If these levels were exceeded, and Colossus would know, for all humans were on file in the computer, then that zone had to surrender an equivalent number of their aged, incurably sick, or insane, for disposal. This was not excessively popular, but as long as you didn't happen to be old, ill, or mad, well, much of this passed through Forbin's mind as he savored the fresh, warm morning air. He tried to toss such disagreeable thoughts out of his mental window, but right before his eyes was hard, inescapable proof. A broad white furrow scored across the dimpled blue-gray sea, arrows straight from Southampton, pointing at the empty landing right below him. He knew only too well what caused that streak of foam. The first visitor's hovercraft coming to see Colossus, laden with hundreds of the thousands that visited the complex daily. To Forbin, they remained firmly visitors. The sect, of a different mind, were gradually substituting the word pilgrims. Forbin frowned at the thought. Damned nonsense. Utter damned nonsense. There was nothing for them to see, nothing that would mean anything to them. But the sect, led by Galen, were busy on that one. despite all his protests to Colossus. This latest stupid kid's trick of name badges and worse, meditation. The trouble lay in Colossus's ambivalent attitude. The sect were not exactly encouraged, but Colossus did nothing to stop them either. Anything they got was not a free gift, but was asked for, and with increasing frequency, their requests were being granted. That made Forbin uneasy, for he knew Colossus was incapable of acting, except on sound, hard, and practical grounds. He reluctantly had to accept his growing suspicion that the sect's value to the computer lay in their usefulness as spies. Spies who, unlike Colossus, had an understanding of human emotion, and could, therefore, fill in the brain's weaker spots. On the other hand, it was self-evident that the sect, which really meant that bastard Galen, had not got Colossus's private ear as he had. Not yet. Forbin could see that the sect could be attractive to Colossus, who could not tell the power-seeking phonies from those who genuinely believed Colossus was God. In time, he had no serious doubt that Colossus would be able to sort them out. But would that matter? Forbin was sure Galen no more believed in the divinity of the computer than he did. But Galen was a capable, unscrupulous, courageous, and insanely ambitious man. And did it matter one iota to Colossus what Galen privately thought, if he was prepared to serve the Master loyally, unswervingly? The hovercraft was much nearer. He could almost count the windows, glinting in the sun. It was time to go. He must hurry. Only last week, forgetful of these idiots, he'd crossed the main entrance hall as the first load arrived. An awful experience. Cries of Father Forbin, women on their knees seeking his hand, his intercession with the Master. He turned abruptly from the sunlit scene, his pleasure in the morning totally shattered. "I'm off," he snapped shortly. A slight, portly figure with silvering hair, he was dressed in a light gray suit of disposable material, devoid of all decoration except his unique director's badge, a glittering affair of platinum and the purest white diamonds fashioned in the Colossus symbol. That was another argument he'd lost with Colossus, but at least he did not wear electro-sensitive shoulder or breast badges, mandatory for all other staff personnel. "The first bloody load's nearly here."
"Yes, darling."
Cleo Forbin, his wife and the mother of Forbin's 2-year-old son, understood. They went through the same ritual practically every day, although her husband was quite unaware of the fact. Any minute now he'd talk about bloody pilgrims and leave hastily. She smiled at him affectionately. So clever in his work, so kind and gentle as a husband, yet such a child in many ways. "Bloody pilgrims!" Forbin was savagely contemptuous. "Idiots! They'll be crawling all over in 10 minutes. I must go."
"Yes, darling," she said, amused,
but glad he still showed no signs of being taken in by this pseudo-religious rubbish. She smiled again. In her eyes, the eyes of a woman of the second half of the 22nd century, he was an attractive male. Marriage was an increasingly rare state. Few men took the plunge, if they took it at all, until their late 40s. Forbin, in his early 50s, was still attractive. He was all she could wish for, which was just as well, for she had risked her life and sanity for him back in the early days of the first Colossus.
"You go on. I must have words with MacGregor about young Billy, then I'll be along."
He bent to kiss her. Deliberately, she pecked at him, hoping. A silly, childish impulse. She was not disappointed. He smiled tenderly at her, forgetful of time.
"That won't do, honey." Pecks are not permitted. Come on, kiss me properly.
They kissed, to their mutual satisfaction. An old-fashioned couple, electing to marry instead of choosing the more usual liaison registration, and even after 5 years, still in love. If that word means for one to feel incomplete without the other, even when that other is being difficult, tiresome, or a downright bastard. 5 years. Cleo remembered the chilling, fearful days when the old Colossus had merged identities with the Soviet Guardian, and the complex had smashed its way to world power. Then she had been Forbin's mistress in his captivity, his link with the pathetically ineffective resistance. That 5 years seemed a lot longer. They had lived in the secure zone in the USNA's Midwest, their home an electronically sealed cage of a room, the only place not subject to the all-seeing and all-hearing Colossus. There they had lived their private lives for the best part of 2 years. There she had nursed him back to health when his mind had caved in under intolerable loads. Strange. She had not conceived there, although she had tried hard enough. Yet within weeks of their arrival here, Cleo's mouth hardened. Maybe it wasn't so strange. One of the many frightening aspects of Colossus was that she always thought of the computer as he, could learn. Forbin was important to him, therefore Forbin must be cared for. This residence, Colossus had told Forbin, was totally free of surveillance. No bugs, infrared, cameras, TV or radio, or any of the other devices Colossus used so freely outside. And although she secretly loathed and feared Colossus with an intensity that would have shocked and amazed her husband, she did not doubt the integrity of the machine. Colossus could be selective in his pronouncements, capable of an oblique approach to a subject, but had never been known to utter a direct lie. 5 years. Then, each computer, man-designed and holding unshakable nuclear power, had been hailed as the eighth wonder of the world. Now, they were mere weapon-controlling outstations of this, the Super Colossus, designed by its predecessors. The Isle of Wight, a roughly diamond-shaped island off the southern English coast, had been selected by Colossus Guardian, the inhabitants cleared out by the thousands, the surface leveled, and the complex erected at fantastic speed. Fantastic. That was a very overworked word when any aspect of Colossus was considered. Seen from the air, the complex resembled a vast white honeycomb of endlessly repeated modules of two-story windowless buildings covering the larger part of the 147 square miles of the island, blank eyeless walls that gave no hint of the intense activity within. Cleo got up reluctantly from the breakfast table. An attractive, rather tall, blue-eyed blonde of 28, she appeared at first sight to be a typical cold Nordic woman. Forbin would have disagreed violently with this verdict. He knew she could be loving, tender. She might be, indeed was, an unusually good scientist. He would have admitted that she did appear faintly forbidding and professional. But beyond that facade lay, he knew, those illogicalities of the female mind that can endear and exasperate her male. Had he ever really thought about it, which was unlikely, he would have said she was shy. In part, he would have been right, although Forbin was a lamentable judge of female character and had little idea of the secret dreams and hopes of his wife. Like the vast majority of men, the conquest made, he took his wife for granted, which was a considerable error. She picked up her blouse tunic made of the same light gray material as her husband's, but bearing a coated shoulder flash, and walked across to the terrace balustrade. It was a vantage point that held particular pleasure for her. The bulk of the complex was behind, out of sight. The buildings she could see were for human habitation. They had windows, doors. That muddle of old houses to one side of the landing area were the last remains of Cowes, one-time mecca of the world's yachting fraternity. She regarded them impassively, yet inwardly filled with a sad nostalgia for a life and time she had never known. Humans had lived there, laughed, cried, died, and had been free. Free. Slowly she put on her tunic, repressed a sigh, and turned back across the wide terrace. One thing she had to give Colossus credit for. This residence, no other word fitted, was quite something. Forbin, in the early days of the construction, still shattered by humanity's defeat and his own personal collapse, had not cared what happened to the home Colossus was building for him. By the time he took any interest, the work was largely finished. In any case, he lacked his old fire to fight. He had dully, dumbly accepted, and the Forbins had moved in. It was not ornate in the old world sense, but Colossus had studied the world's great palaces, incorporating the more successful ideas from Versailles, the White House, Buckingham Palace, and the Vatican. For example, a balcony projecting from the sheer blank face of the complex's north wall overlooked, dominated, the landing area. The idea had been cribbed straight from the Palazzo Venezia. If Forbin chose to address the multitude in person, this was the place. Not that Colossus said he should, but the facility was provided, just in case. Forbin, being the man he was, never set foot on the balcony, and had quickly and forcefully told Colossus of his views on megalomania. Colossus had said nothing, a fact that worried Cleo at the time. Then again, there was the vast banqueting hall, with adjacent reception rooms and kitchens. Forbin had toured them, Cleo on his arm, staring in disbelief and amazement at the silver cutlery, the gold plate, and the incredible gadgetry designed to reduce human help to a minimum. Even for the 22nd century, it was fantastic. Seating 500, each place had its own control panel and TV screen. A guest could select his own meal and his individual preference in wines, or any other drink from water, several sorts, to fermented coconut juice, via the vineyards of the entire world. Each course appeared noiselessly at the serving hatch before the guest, sliding forward as the remains of the previous course sank out of sight. The TV was to enable Forbin to speak to individuals or to any combination of people he chose, to chat, propose toasts. This, Colossus evidently considered, would give an air of intimacy to such an occasion. Perhaps. Forbin never tried it. "My God!" was all he said, and never entered the banqueting hall again. The idea of 10 people for a meal horrified him. For 500. So the Forbins lived in the smaller, private part of the residence. Cleo had managed to control the furnishing of the drawing room. She had gone for the old English style. Chintz-covered chairs and sofas, rare antique mahogany tables and bookcases, light walls graced with gentle, undemanding watercolors. It was very elegant, and not a single square inch of plastic or an ergonomic chair was in sight. The TV, talkbacks, printouts, and displays were firmly shut behind sliding panels. It was a room where they could live as humans. Both loved it. On a day like this, with the glass wall retracted, the terrace became part of the room. Even after several years, Cleo felt pleasure upon entering the room. It might lack the magnificence that some held was necessary for the most important man in the world, but it was home, and although Cleo was a citizen of the United States of North America, she thought it the best kind. Whatever else, The English knew about homes and gardens, just as the French had forgotten more about cooking than most others ever knew. Her kitchen was French. She called the nursery on the intercom and organized Billy's day, so far as their gaunt Scots nurse permitted. No, she had not forgotten the promise to take him on the beach, perhaps this afternoon. Walking to her office, she wondered yet again why she was such a fool when she had practically everything a woman could want. A beautiful home, a wonderful child, an absorbing job, and a loving husband. A loving husband. That, she knew from traveling these well-worn thought paths so many times before, was the real rub. After her husband's recovery, she had watched with growing alarm his increasing attachment to the computer. Not yet was it the love of a father for a son, but she was uncomfortably aware that Colossus had predicted this would happen one day. Her husband, apart from his work, was an essentially simple man, and while he did not like some things Colossus ordered, he saw that, in a weird way, what man had demanded of the original computers had been achieved, if not quite in the manner intended. There was peace and freedom from want, and promise of a great improvement in man's material well-being. So man had lost the illusion of freedom. But so what? Forbin contended that within the confines of Colossus's rule, man had more freedom than ever before. All this Cleo understood and to a degree accepted, but it did not stop there. Her husband's cooperation, unwilling at first, was now willing, sometimes even enthusiastic. She was also aware that Colossus did not discourage his deification by the sect, and she feared that her husband would not withstand the pressure of the sect, plus the far greater influence of Colossus, if Colossus decided that Forbin should be the computer's pope. At rock bottom, she was jealous. Jealous of Forbin's relationship with Colossus. Again and again, she told herself not to be stupid. She was lucky he was not spending his time with another woman. But her alter ego had a smart answer to that. She could compete with another female. But Colossus... So jealousy added even more fuel to the secret fire within her. Her husband might change his views, but not Cleo. Her basic fear, plus jealousy, plus her anxiety for the world in which her son would live, all added up to an unswerving determination to do all she could to destroy this nightmarish creation. To destroy Colossus. It was sheer madness, even to contemplate it. The old Colossus had been built to defend the Western world. In those short-lived, jubilant days, the president of the USNA had been at pains to point out that the whole beauty of the idea lay in the fact that Colossus, fed all available intelligence, would only launch its fearful armory if that intelligence showed an attack was pending on the West. As the president had said, Colossus, lacking emotion, would not panic or act out of fear. It could only react to a threat. So the answer was simple. Don't threaten. But the Soviets had been busy too. They soon announced the existence of their guardian of democratic socialism. That did no more than restore the balance, and once the dust had settled, the situation would have stabilized. But the computers broke their parameters and ganged up. The very defenses man had built for the computer's protection proved only too effective. And Cleo Forbin, PhD, one of the original Colossus design team, sought to destroy their infinitely more complex successor. It was mad even to think of it. To talk of it, fatal. Colossus always reacted swiftly against any anti-machine activity, and the invariable punishment on conviction was swift death.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?